4. The Marked Environment. In London, at the January demolition conference, Lai Chun had met a woman. Which was what she'd intended to do since she and her long-term partner Ya Ling had split up. She just hadn't had the time with one thing and another. She made dates and canceled, hooked up with women at trade shows and never called them. And then, at a conference in London, a woman was standing before her, who was all she'd ever wanted. Jun hadn't even bothered to check who she was interviewing for the fantail showcase. It was a boring-ass event on the subject, fantail as a survival tool, which fantail wasn't and couldn't be. There was a pre-written list of questions. The PR had told Jun in advance that the fantail spokesperson would not answer questions including, what is Lank Skellish like to work for? What are the qualities in you that mean you're able to tolerate working with him? Do you have any thoughts, in this survival context, about whether your boss has personally done things that make life on Earth less survivable? Is he really investing in rejuvenation technology that uses children's lymph fluid? How would you answer claims that his electric monorail company is a scam to extract public money in exchange for creating literally no infrastructure whatsoever? What on earth made him take to Fantail Swift social video to accuse that mountain rescue team in Borneo helping a group of elderly veterans of being dog fuckers? All of that, yes, was out of bounds. It was going to be a dull, by-the-numbers interview taking place for maximum corporate visibility at a stage plastered with logos in the hotel's main concourse. The audience would be whoever happened to drift past. The acoustics would be terrible. The whole thing was a box-checking exercise. So there was no point knowing who the fantail spokesperson was, because they'd all be the same, and the answers would be identical. She'd arrived to the interview late, hungover, had only noticed on the way from the elevator to the stage that a ripped sachet of lube was still stuck to the bottom of her shoe from the previous night's adventure. As a runner went to find her guest, Jun peeled the sachet off her right gym shoe, dumped it in the trash, wiped her fingers on her jeans, realized there was a spot of mayonnaise on her jacket collar, and, well, here we are, Jun. You're a survival expert. Fucking survive it. Lai Chun, creator of Surly Survivor, said the runner, please meet your interviewee for this event, Martha Einkorn, assistant to Lank Skellish. A sachet of lube was stuck to the rim of the trash bin. It was right there. Jun's eyes flicked to it. Why wouldn't it just fall? I'm a great fan of Surly Survivor. You're on NTD, right? Said Martha Einkorn. I'm honored. I'm so sorry I'm late. It was just, Jun began, and actually looked at the person she was talking to. Martha Einkorn was white with creamy, smooth skin, heavyset, wearing a navy jumpsuit with a gold pinstripe and a string of pearls around her neck. Her face was scattered with freckles. Oh, thought Jun. Hello. It was just unavoidable, her mouth said for her. Hmm, said Martha Einkorn. I guess you're going to have to find some way to make it up to me. There was a look, a definite twitch of the lips, a raise of the eyebrow. Right, thought Chun, as she felt a hot electric tingle travel through her groin. This was unexpected. The audience was sparse. Half of them would probably turn out to be in the wrong place as soon as Chun and Martha started speaking. I expect I can think of some way to make this worth your time. Martha gave a small, slow smile. Chun licked her bottom lip. Okay. Even going through the approved questions, something was happening between them on stage. Jun tried a little joke, and Martha added to it, expanded upon it. Martha leaned forward in her chair. Jun moved a little closer. She could smell Martha's perfume, something musky. It smelled of sex. If they hadn't been on stage, Jun might have thought they were on a date. Martha's voice, clear, low, mellifluous, was almost hypnotic. Jun was listening to her speak, but thinking constantly of how it would be to undo her jumpsuit, to touch that dimpled skin, to put her mouth to that soft neck and trace a line with her lips down to her breasts. "So," Jun asked directly from the prompter, "I think you have examples of how Fantail has helped people during weather emergencies." "Sure," said Martha. "The great benefit of Fantail is a lot of people have Fantail." Jun laughed, a bit too hard, she thought, a bit too long. "That's a great point," said Jun, thinking anything, anything to keep this rapport building. "So during the hurricane season in Haiti, we brought in emergency cell towers on drones, giving instant free access to Fantail. People used it to find each other, to tell people where to find fresh drinking water and safe buildings above the floodline." "Amazing," said Shun, knowing in the back of her mind that someone in the small audience would already be posting about how fucking dark it was that they'd enabled communication, but only through their own platform. But it didn't matter. No one would ever see this interview. "You're really trying to make a difference." "We are, actually. We have a responsibility to use what we have to try to help. You know," Martha leaned forward, "that series you made from Niger about water scarcity and violence, the gangs taking over. Fantail sharing technologies would really make sense as an intervention there."
"You've seen my stuff from Niger?"
"It's brilliant reporting. I bet everyone in this audience has watched it." Heat rose in Jun's cheeks. This was probably her least watched series. It had been critically well received, but just didn't do the numbers. Her audience wanted an exciting apocalypse and information about how they, in particular, would survive it, and not the downer reality of human beings dying of thirst only 300 miles from a catastrophic flood.
"What did you think of it?"
"You made it real for me, in a way I'd never seen before. You were in the fall of Hong Kong, right? You know what it's like to be there for real. It shows."
There was a flashing in the corner of Chun's eye. The prompter wanted her to move on to the next real question. "Fine.
And how can Fantail technology help?"
Martha said, "A million ways. I grew up on the land, and the kind of emergency communications Fantail is rolling out now would have made a huge difference to me when I was living on 15,000 green acres in Oregon."
Chun startled out of her sexual reverie. 15,000 green acres, that precise phrasing. Jun had a memory for the apocalypse and its related plans and aficionados.
"Just a second," said Jun. "Did you—"
She looked at the audience. Several of them had already wandered off to listen to the panel across the hall, chaired by a young black woman with bright pink hair and a miniature robot on her palm.
"I'm just thinking, a property that large, Oregon. I have to ask, did you grow up an Enochite?"
This was not on the list of prescribed questions, but it wasn't on the list of forbidden questions. Martha Einkorn blinked, stumbled, composed herself. They had both been lulled by the hum of sex between them, drowsy like bees in smoke. Chun had asked a question she shouldn't have asked, and Martha answered the question she shouldn't have answered.
"Yes," said Martha Einkorn. "There's nothing to be ashamed of there. It's a matter of public record. I was only a child then. My father was Enoch."
From the bored spectators, there was a sudden, fascinated buzz. Chun guessed maybe a third of them might have heard of the Enochites. They were famous among fanatical survivalists, gun enthusiasts, and religious extremists. A cautionary tale among people who were obsessively paranoid about government overreach. Not the kind of apocalypse amateur who would come to a weak sauce event like Fantail as a survival tool. But Jun saw lips mouthing sub-vocalizations to search engines embedded in their clothing, touching their smart torques, connecting to the great communal brain.
"Wow," said Jun. "So what was that like?"
Martha was silent. Jun let it sit. This was one of the tricks of interviewing. don't fill the silence.
Oh, Martha said at last, the Enochites weren't everything you hear. I learned some good values there. If you haven't heard of them, we were a survivalist group raising children in Oregon and waiting for the end of the Babel being this world.
She gestured around the hotel concourse, the signs and lists of workshops and panels for the day, the coffee and pretzel stands, the tangles of people carrying tote bags branded with Shout Radio Flare and Foxhole Emergency Ammo.
The Babel is a complicated place, full of signs, where we all live. Enoch believed it would, and should, come to an end.
And that was your dad.
Look, we kids learned a lot of great skills. Hunting, fishing, setting traps, growing and gathering our own food, sleeping outdoors. I sometimes say I grew up about as close to a hunter-gatherer as anybody can in the U.S. Well, outside of the First Nations and Native communities we did all that genocide on, of course.
On smart torques and visor wedges, thin screens and wrist displays, almost everyone in the audience was internet searching, presumably for the Enochites. At this whole event now, Jun was the person who knew the least about Enochites. She dredged her memory. The Enochites were a divisive subject among survivalists, almost a myth. They had been, for a few years in the mid-2020s, a big deal. A new Judaism-based, Genesis-inflected American religion that flared up and died away rapidly. Their leader, Enoch, had big ideas about the organization of the world, although Jun couldn't now precisely remember any of them. They'd lived on an enormous rural compound in Oregon, and Enoch had been unusual in the right wing at that time for accepting the reality of climate change, for interpreting it as a sign of God's will. He believed that God would use the weather, like in the flood, to separate the righteous from the sinners. There was a sub-board dedicated to them on Name the Day, but Jun had never looked at it. They were basically gone now. At the end, there had been a tragedy, something about a fire, and then there had been financial stuff and... wait.
New York City.
The subway, said Jun, something bubbling up from the back of her mind.
Didn't Enoch go mental on the subway? Didn't he threaten people and steal their wallets?
Martha Einkorn sat back in her chair.
Is that how people remember that now?
Jesus. She passed a hand over her face.
He didn't steal wallets. He had a vision, okay? Enoch. He was born Ralph Zimmerman, my dad. He had a vision on a subway train. People thought they were using money, but the money was using them. He grabbed people's wallets and pocketbooks and stamped on them to save people.
He sounds frightening and unpredictable, said Shun. Martha shook her head.
No one follows anyone if they're not right about something.
So what was your dad right about?
Martha chewed her lip.
There was the air of a date about this still, the permission to ask forbidden questions, and the deliberate creation of intimacy. Jun had the feeling Martha was calculating something.
Okay, Enoch used to say, the city is a marked environment, like a marked deck of cards, fixed so we can read it easily, filled with symbols. Paving slabs are for walking on, blacktop is for cars.
She pointed around the hall to the cup sign over the cafe, the signs for the restrooms.
Symbols for food, drink, empty your bladder. And look, the real world's not like that. The world doesn't exist for our convenience. It doesn't talk in our language. The wilderness doesn't have symbolic drawings to tell you where to find food or where it's safe to take a piss. Where you find a sign in the real world, it's a sign made by the thing itself. Deer tracks are made by deer hooves. Do you see? It's done something weird to us to live in this human-made, human-centric space all the time. It's made us more selfish, but also more anxious and more depressed because we think everything's about us. I think Enoch was right about that. And yet you still left. You know, he was right about some things, but he was also angry and sometimes violent, and he refused to educate us properly. You can't do what he did without control and eventually abuse. You can't hold the whole world at bay with a couple hundred minds. You just can't. To do what he wanted to do, you'd have to remake the whole world. Several people standing at the edges of the event or sitting in the audience were filming the exchange on their phones or wrist screens. Though Jun didn't know it yet, a short clip was already bouncing from account to account on Fantail, on Medlar Connect, on Anvil Chat. In the clip, Jun says, "Didn't Enoch go mental on the subway?" In the great interconnected human mind, certain connections were being made, and certain people were becoming angry, and certain platforms were motivated to drive engagement. But all Jun knew in that moment was that Martha Einkorn smelled of musk and promise, that she liked her, she wanted to know her better, and something was blooming between them. At the end of the event, Martha shook Jun's hand and pulled her in for a quick embrace. She muttered, "I get finished at 9 p.m. When Jun opened her hand, she found she was holding a hotel room key, black with a gilt edge. Jun felt the key with her thumb. It felt like a kiss. It felt like falling. It felt like an expert finger parting her labia. "You're done for now," thought Jun as she walked from the event in a sexual daze. "You're absolutely done for."